the University of Washington Computer Science and Engineering Distinguished Lecture Series.
Great to have you here for one of our distinguished lectures this year. It's really easy to introduce somebody who truly needs no introduction. Dave Patterson has been at Berkeley since 1977, is that right? 76. Got his degrees from UCLA, where, among other things, he ran into our former department chair, Jean-Lou Baer. He may say a few words about that, but Jean-Lou was a grad student at UCLA at the time with Jerry Estrin, who eventually was Dave's advisor. Do I have that right? So a lot of connections. Dave is a leading light internationally in computer systems, computer architecture, is responsible for a huge proportion of the projects that have put Berkeley on the map. RISC was a number of years ago, and it's coming back now after a few years of parallel computing and things like that, data science. So it's great to have Dave with us. Thanks for joining us, Dave.
Thanks. I'm going to do 50 years of computer architecture in 15 minutes, and then going to talk about what about open source instruction sets, and then how do you build chips today, and it's kind of this entering this golden era of architecture. And then at the end, I'm going to, after the Q&A period, I'm going to do my personal story. Graduate students seem to think that if you've had some success, you've had a perfectly smooth road your whole career, and I'll tell you what really happened, and the role that Jean-Lou Baer played in that. Okay, let's go back 50 years. IBM had this big problem. They had four independent lines of computers with four different instruction sets, four different operating systems, four different marketing groups. So what they decided to do, the smart guys got together and said that they would bet the company that they could integrate all these four lines together behind a single instruction set called the IBM System 360. So that architecture, believe it or not, still survives today. They would announce on a single day several different models of the same thing. And for those of you who wondered, this was the machine that popularized the 8-bit byte. Before that, characters were a different number of bits. For those of us from that era, when they see one of these green cards, like tears form in their eyes, what you would do is you would fold this card in three pieces, and you'd keep it in your pocket, which was a real fashion statement, you know, for the time. And, you know, or you keep it in your purse. But you would pull this out and you'd look at the instruction set because you're programming in assembly language to do that. Now, then and now, the hard part of designing the processor is the control. So if you think of the processor as the data path, which is the brawn that does the work, and control is the brain, the hard part is the brain. How is IBM going to put all these different instruction sets together? Well, Maurice Wilks, one of the pioneers of computing and a Turing Award winner, had this idea. Since at the technology that he was dealing with, logic was a lot more expensive than memory, and read-only memory was a lot cheaper and faster than alterable memory, we would design the control as read-only memory, as kind of instructions that you would program, and he called that microprogramming of microinstructions. So IBM needed an idea to pull this together, so they bet on microprogramming. And when they announced it, these four different machines were different programmed. As you can see, the data path width varied by a factor of 8. The clock cycle varied by almost a factor of 4. And then they would charge different amounts. Back then, IBM would rent it to you, lease it to you. And this is what this next to last row is in 1964 dollars. In 2015 dollars, to rent it, for 1 year, the high-end machine was $3 million a year, rent for 1 year. So IBM bet the company on this idea, and they won the bet, and IBM was a very, very profitable company for many years. What happened in the rest of the computer industry, Moore's Law came along, so the logic, RAM, and ROM was all built out of transistors, MOS transistors. And in that technology, the RAM and the ROM are about the same speed. So what happened with Moore's Law is the control stores got a lot bigger, which meant you could accommodate much more complicated instruction sets, which we called SIS for complex instruction set computers. And the kind of the prototypical example was the VAX architecture then in 1978. Now, the microprocessor guys didn't really understand computer architecture that much. So what they would do is just imitate the mini computer people like DEC or the virtual servers or the big guys, the mainframes. They just imitate what they did, who knew architecture. So there are a few different projects then. Gordon Moore, amazingly enough, recognized they had an 8-bit computer at the time, the 8080, that the next instruction set they did was going to last for the rest of the life of the company. So what he did was hired a bunch of PhDs, sent them up to Portland, and had them design the next great instruction set. If you wanted to go, to be hired by those guys, they were so enthusiastic about the future, they wouldn't tell you what they're working on. They said, they promise it'd be the greatest project ever. After you get on board, we'll tell you what we're working on. Alas, 3 years into the project, they went to Gordon Moore and said, well, it's the future, but it's not going to be done on time. So we're going to miss this milestone to get it out there. You're not going to have a 16-bit instruction set computer out there in time for the marketplace. So Intel did an emergency project, and in 10 weeks, they designed the instruction set of the 8086. And then within a year, they had a chip that was available to use. It wasn't all that popular, but it was out there in the marketplace. So when IBM in Florida decided to build the personal computer, they needed a microprocessor. They liked the instruction set of the Motorola 68000, but it was late. So the 8086 was there, and they used it. And so they hoped they'd sell 250,000 of them. Instead, they sold hundreds of millions of them, and that's why the 8086s dominates the machine today. Had the Motorola been there on time, it wouldn't be a Wintel monopoly. It'd be a Wotola monopoly or something. What happened to those microcoded machines? Well, John Koch at IBM, another Turing Award winner, they were exploring the RISC ideas. They were building a big computer, a mini computer. Those are boards from that computer at the time. But he, one of the best things he did was the compiler technology. So he retargeted his RISC compiler technology at that mainframe computer, the IBM 370. But he only used the simple instructions, the loads and stores and the register-register operations. What happened? It went faster. So if you didn't use the complicated instructions, it went two or three times faster. Although they didn't publish this, some people at DEC who are working on the VAX architecture measured it, and they found that 20% of the instructions were responsible for 60% of the microcode, and they were almost never used. I had done my sabbatical a few years before, or in 1979, and I had done my dissertation on microcode verification, and I came back and wrote a paper. There were so many bugs in the complicated instruction set of the VAX architecture that if the microprocessor guys imitated the VAX, that they were going to have bugs in the chips in the field, so they're going to have repairable chips in the field. So what happened to that paper? It was rejected. And the reviewers said, that's a stupid way to design chips. So I had these two conflicting notions in my mind. A, they were going to imitate the VAX, and B, if they did it, it was going to be a stupid design. So that led me to the RISC stuff. So what happened with RISC? So basically, the memories that you would build the microcode out of for a CISC architecture, you could instead build an instruction cache out of it for simpler instructions. So that meant the way caching works is the things that we're using would depend on what program is running. So that seemed like a good idea. By keeping them simpler, it was much easier to pipeline them. And because of Moore's law, we had enough transistors on a chip that at least for a simple processor, we could get a 32-bit data path on there. So you could build a 32-bit microprocessor, pipeline microprocessor, and that worked better. Now, surprisingly, we had a hard time convincing people of this because we executed more instructions. John Hennessy came up with this explanation, which seems obvious in retrospect. You can factor program execution to these pieces. So time per program, how long it takes to run in seconds, into the three factors of instructions per program, which depends on the source code and the compiler technology and instruction set. The clock cycles per instruction is the middle term, and that's the average number of clock cycles, which depends on the instruction set and the underlying microarchitecture, and then the clock cycle time. So those are the three factors. And what the insight was, well, RISC does execute more instructions the first term, but it executes a lot fewer clock cycles per instruction on average. Therefore, that's why RISC was better than the CISC architectures. So at the time, the IBM people did mini computers, but we decided to do RISC microprocessors. We did two of them. The first one worked fine, RISC one. Second one was even more efficient, ran quite a bit faster. And the Stanford guys built some too. That's it. That's my reference to Stanford. And so earlier this year, IEEE honored the RISC one effort with a plaque that says it was the first RISC microprocessor. So, you know, Ed and I have been around a while, but when you go to work and you see something you worked on as a brass plaque on the wall, you know you've been around a while. Okay, what happened to CIS versus RISC? In the PC era, what the Intel guys did was just translate the x86 instructions internally into RISC instructions, and then any good idea the RISC guys had, they could do. It cost them a little bit more. But they eventually sold more than 350 million a year, which is impressive, and that instruction set dominated everything. It dominated not only PCs, but it dominated servers. That's the PC era. Since we're in the post-PC era with client cloud computing, what's happened now? A big change, which I'll repeat a lot, is instead of a microprocessor that you get from Intel or AMD, we're in the era of systems on a chip. So somebody else is building the chips, and they're getting intellectual property, like from ARM, to put on that chip. So that's a different era today. And in this era, besides performance, which is what the RISC-CIS debate was about, it's also die area and energy. 16 billion processors were shipped last year. More than two for everybody on the whole planet. And 98% of those are RISC processors. So in the post-PC era, we have a different champion. Okay, so that's, you know, 60s, 70s, and 80s. The 90s, a provocative idea came along called very long instruction word. Here, you would have kind of lots of operations in a single long instruction that could operate independently. It was really easy to build the hardware. The hardware didn't have to do anything, just have multiple functional units. And it was up to the compiler to fill in those slots of the instruction to do. So the compiler had the hard job there. Had to guarantee there were no dependencies, had to guarantee the parallelism, not have any hazards up to the compiler. How it did that, a typical example would be loop unrolling. So if it would enroll this loop four times, on the left is the code that would be generated, and then you'd fill in these very long instruction words, in this case, with four loads, four adds, and four stores, assuming that the latency between the load and the add was three clock cycles, and between the add and the store was four clock cycles. As you can see there, there are lots of empty slots. So what the challenge for the compiler was to do tricks like this, find other instructions to put in the empty slots, so on average, you'd execute a lot of cycles. So that was a research idea. Intel was running out of address bits for the 32-bit address space, so it was time to think about the 64-bit successor. They decided what they'd do is change the instruction set and embrace VLIW. Now, they wanted to have their own word for it, so they called it EPIC for explicitly parallel instruction set computer, but it's basically VLIW. Not only did Intel announce decide that that's what they're going to do, they joined forces with Hewlett-Packard, which was a dominant computer company at the time. So HP and Intel worked together to do this instruction set. The first implementation, kind of like the 432, was years late. It wasn't that fast, but the second one was pretty good. And they said the first one was kind of a mulligan for you golfers, and that didn't count, but this one counted. So what happened to the EPIC? It was an EPIC failure. What was wrong? Unpredictable branches were really hard for VLIW. Similarly, unpredictable cache misses are really hard for VLIW. How do they fill in the slots when you don't know how long it's going to take? And code size got a lot better. But Don Knuth, another Turing awarder, said, yeah, it kind of needed this magic compiler. It was predicated on that. It just turned out there wasn't that much instruction level parallelism. It was too hard to build that compiler. It was such a big marketing campaign, though, that it won despite its technical failures. Several companies gave up what they were doing since Intel and HP said, this is the future, you better get on board. They did it. When it started to not work, it was like the emperor had new clothing. And so, as this columnist said, it became a joke in the industry. The product name of their EPIC thing was called the Itanium, and so it soon got the nickname Itanic after a famous ship. And this is from a magazine at the time showing software companies getting to lifeboats while the Itanium is Itanic is sinking into the cold sea. And it really did sink. They still sell them. Maybe they sell 1,000 systems a year, but it was like the 432. It was a lot of promise, but not any reality. Okay, that was the 90s. In all these cases in computer architecture, and like other fields, like billions of dollars. Which one's right? Billions of dollars bet on both sides, and then we find out. Next step is scalable multiprocessors. And there were two schools of thought, again. Shared memory, where everything's cache coherent, non-uniform memory access. I'll show you what that means. And the Dash project led by my friend John Hennessy and the Flash project's pioneer, they were the champions of that design. And then the alternative is what we would call a cluster today with separate address spaces, and you had to communicate using RPC or MPI. That was the Networkers Workstation project at Berkeley, which not only did I work on, but Tom Anderson, right around here somewhere, and David Culler worked on that. But this was the idea, is everybody was going to have a switch and links to connect them together, and then the non-uniform memory access machines would be, if you're, whoops, this doesn't show up on the screen, oh well. The memory that's nearest you would be fast, and the memory that you had to go switch for would be far away, so that's why it's non-uniform access. But the scalable NUMAs would keep everything cache coherent. So it would, if you had, you'd have a copy in your local one, it would invalidate it if somebody else wrote it, so it was a lot of work, and they would build sophisticated switches. So a typical of the time was the SGI Origin, which was based on the DASH architecture. In fact, several of the Stanford students went to SGI to build that architecture. In fact, what they called the name of their custom link is NumaLink 2, because NumaLink 1 was the version at Stanford. And this one with 128 processors, about 10 million. At Berkeley, we were building the cluster on the right-hand side out of Sun workstations and standard switches. And you can see it was a much slower link. The emphasis at SGI was scientific computing. We started off scientific computing, but then we had a colleague, Eric Brewer, who said this would be really great for search and other applications. So I had to go back to my old slides to remember the pros and cons here, but this is from a course. So the NUMA advantages was ease of programming, since the hardware would automatically do the communication for you. You could use the good old thing that if you had a small multiprocessor, that saved programming style worked for that. Because it was done at the hardware, much lower communication overhead, used the bandwidth more efficiently, you only communicated the data that you absolutely needed. Basically another way of saying the thing, it decides when you have to communicate remotely or not. The hardware does that for you. What's wrong with clusters? It looked like not one big machine like the NUMA, like lots of independent machines, so the cost of administration was much higher than the multiprocessor. You're not connected at the memory bus, it's through the I/O bus, so it's not as fast, the bandwidth isn't good, and the latency is longer, so that's not so good. The memories are all independent in a cluster, and at the time, memory was expensive, so everybody had to have their own copy of the operating system, own copy of the applications, so you would spend more in DRAM on a cluster. But the advantages were, a big one was error isolation. If a single node failed, it would be probably limited to that node. You could upgrade it, replace, if something broke, you could replace it while things were still running. It was much easier to scale the system up to much larger sizes. You could do it with NUMA, but it was pretty expensive, and there was an upper limit. You could build really big clusters. And then the big deal was the cost, is by building with off-the-shelf machines, you could get the large volumes, both for the switches and for the processors, as opposed to the NUMA that was unique and not very many of them. So first, Inktomi, which is the search engine that Eric Brewer led, and then everybody else in the Valley did that. And here's the slide I found when I was looking through these slides, which is from, if you see in the lower left corner, it's from almost 15 years ago. And the question I asked at the bottom is, and so this is 6 years before the iPhone, I think, is the future services built on Google-like clusters delivered to gadgets like cell phone handsets? And the answer was yes, that was the future. So the debate at the time was, you know, architects weren't so clear what the applications were. We thought it was going to be scientific computing, and that was John's arguments. It ended up being, internet services. And all the advantages on that last side about scalability and fault isolation thing were much more important than those other things. So clusters won. So there's 50 years of computer architecture.
Before the iPhone.
Yeah, 6 years right. Before the iPhone, yeah. I was pretty happy to see that slide in that
exactly.
Deck. So I think, I put it as a question because I wasn't willing to say, the future is. I said, oh, the future might be. All right, that brings us up to today. Okay, so what's going on today in computer architecture? Surprisingly, there's consensus on instruction sets. No one's built a CISC instruction set in 30 years. The VLIW, lots of people have tried it, and for general purpose applications, it hasn't worked. Now, in signal processing markets, it's found a niche, so in some simpler software it's worked, but for the general purpose one, it hasn't really worked. So risk. So I'm sure I gave a talk at University of Washington 30-some years ago. The same ideas still hold up pretty well. Who would have guessed? That's widespread agreement. Now, what's weird about computer architecture, and like all other systems, is we don't have an open source version. Everybody else has open standards and open implementations but us. Why? Why don't we have them? Basically, instruction sets don't matter. It's for performance, it's everything else, right? It's the algorithms, the compilers, the circuits, the memory technology. Everything else is more important than the instruction set for performance reasons. But from money, it does matter, because it's the most important interface where software meets the hardware. And to move software to it, it's expensive if you have a different instruction set. And that's where most of the cost is for a new chip, if you is developing the software for it. Not only that, with these modern systems on a chip, they have lots of instruction sets. So you think about the ARM processor that's on here. That's on the right-hand side. That's the one that it's visible that you download programs to. But there's all kinds of other processors. GPUs, image processors, signal processors, lots of them, maybe a dozen different instruction sets on them. So there's a lot of cost in porting all that software to it. So if the choice of the instruction set doesn't impact system energy and performance, and it costs a lot to use different ones, why isn't there an open one? And the answer is there's no good technical reason for that. There's business and historical reasons, but no good technical reason. It's not that AMD and Intel forgot to do it. Oh, you're supposed to make it open. The guy forgot to do it, right? No, they hire lawyers. Lawyers go after you if you copy what they have without permission. And they don't do most of the software development. Everybody else does all the software development. They do a little bit of software development. And it doesn't take a company like AMD or Intel to design an instruction set. Lots of people can do that day. It's a lot of work, but it's certainly doable. And it's not like their instruction sets are exemplars of the best instruction set ever designed. You know, they're popular. That's all you can say about them. It's like music, right? They're not. It's not great music, but it's popular. Sure.
Are software APIs copyrightable or not?
You're asking me, are software APIs copyrightable? Wasn't there just a big lawsuit about that?
Yeah,
between
I don't remember
Google
the answer.
I don't know the answer. Does anybody here know the answer? I think they, was it yes or no?
It's being appealed.
Yes, I think I was certainly of the case that you shouldn't be able to patent it, and I think I was on the side that lost, and it's under appeal. Is that right? Yeah.
Just another API, right?
So. Yeah. Yes. But you know, if we can't copy it, we don't. You know, there's better ways to do that. It doesn't take a company to verify this. This is a well-specified interface. Hard things are like networking interfaces or Wi-Fi interfaces, and we even know how to do standards around this. This is pretty straightforward, well-defined things. It doesn't even protect you from lawsuits. NVIDIA believes that ARM is violating their GPU patents with their Mali processor, and that Imagination is violating their patents with their GPU. So who are they suing? Are they suing, you know, ARM and Imagination? No, they're suing Samsung and Qualcomm for using chips that use their ideas. So it doesn't protect you from lawsuits. And finally, proprietary instruction sets are tied to the success of the company who owns them. So when DEC went out of business, it took down the VAX and Alpha instruction sets, and Alpha RISC architecture, which many people like, it went away when DEC did. So it can actually go away. So suppose we had free and open instruction sets. Well, a lot more people could design cores, so there'd be more competition. If you think you like the idea of open cores that you could download and use, you got to have an open instruction set. And if we had them, it's the same arguments for open source software. Shorter time to market, lower cost from reuse, fewer errors, given lots of eyeballs. And then the new thing is people are worried about people doing things secretly to your code to put things in there so they can break in. A researcher made a single line to one description of a processor, one line of Verilog out of many thousands, and he was able to use that from a user program to break into it. So how do you know there's not something in there that's a trap door? And it's pretty hard to figure out how to do that except for lots of people look at it. For Internet of Things, people are excited about this. No royalties would probably make it cheaper. And then the nice thing is, like our colleagues in compilers and operating systems and databases, we could be working on stuff in our research group that could benefit the whole world directly, not just through our papers. And then the education stuff we would do would be more realistic if this took off. So Why is this happening now? As I said earlier, I think the big deal is from SoCs instead of microprocessors. So ARM proved that somebody else can come up with the instruction set or the processor, and many people can fab it. Now that ARM has proven that, now lots of people can do it, including open source groups. And I think the ends of Moore's law. Conventional wisdom, computer architecture, transistors aren't getting any, are getting better at a very slow rate now compared to the Moore's law's days. So the only way we're going to get advances is big advances in architectural improvement, which means, Renaissance times for architects. We're going to have new special purpose processors out there. They need new ideas to get performance improvements. Often when people do that, they'll invent their own funny little instruction set to put their secret sauce thing in there. Instead, why don't you use a standard open one and just add your secret sauce to that? And so that's why I think things are getting popular now. We're not the first ones to try open source instruction sets. Sun, to its credit, tried to do it 20 years ago. There's an open risk effort actually based on Hennessy's My Book, the instruction set that was in there. But they were just in the wrong era. You know, they weren't in the SoC era. So companies didn't want to start manufacturing chips that of an open design, so that didn't work. Where did RISC-V come from? About 5 years ago, but I forgot to say this at the beginning, but this is work is being led by Christo Osanovich, and I'm helping him. In my senior years, my job is to help younger faculty be more successful, and that's what I'm doing. So 5 years ago, he said, it's time for us to do a new instruction set. We've tried a bunch of them. The obvious ones today going forward are x86 and ARM, but even though Intel was a sponsor, they didn't want us making open cores on the x86 instruction set, and ARM was very litigious about people trying to do that. The MIPS architecture, we wanted to expand the opcodes, and they didn't have enough opcodes to be able to do that. So Krista started a three-month project to develop their own instruction set, and 4 years later, he was done. Now, along the way, I'll tell you lots of chips and research publications. But how did we get into this? So what was going on? We were using it in our classes. And then we started getting complaints from companies is, but how come you changed the instruction set from the 152 course in the spring to the fall? So we get all kinds of complaints from companies. But complaining about changing the instruction set in courses is a new standard, right? So we went and talked to them, what's going on? Why do you guys care what we're doing in our courses? Well, basically, there was a thirst out there for an open source instruction set. They thought this was a pretty good one. It would serve their needs. And so they were starting to do it on their own. So once we recognized that there was a need for an open source instruction set, we said, well, this would be pretty cool. So for about the last 12 or 18 months, we've been trying to make this happen. So what's our modest goal? It's world domination. Yeah, we don't see why a single instruction set can't span everything from Internet of Things to the warehouse scale computer. We think technically that should be done. So how do we implement that? So basically, we have three different instruction sets with different address sizes. So we did the 32 and 64-bit ones because that was an obviously important thing to do. And then as a joke, we did a 128-bit one just to show that we could do it. Since we did that as a joke, two things have happened. First of all, the switch from disk to flash memory means we will soon have warehouse-scale computers with more than 2 to the 64th bytes of flash memory. You might want to be able to address that. The second thing is there are people interested in security who like the idea of a much bigger address space that they could play with. So there seem to be two actual use cases in the next couple of years for the really big address space. And the 32-bit and 64 ones are clearly needed. Here's the big ideas here. First of all, there's a minimum set of classic RISC integer instructions in which everything runs on. So the compilers and operating systems just need that to have a working system. And then, because it's an SoC that you do custom, there's standard extensions that you can include or not, depending whether you need them. So multiply and divide if you want them, atomic instructions, single and double system floating point. We call that set G for general purpose. We think that'll be a popular set of combinations. But there's also quad precision floating point and compressed instructions to make code size smaller. We also have a bunch of opcodes set aside for people to use to do the secret sauce instructions per SoC, and all of the above in straightforward RISC encoding. So this is the base instructions. The opcodes are always the same size. They're all 32 bits. There's 31 registers plus a R0 register. The destination sources and sources are always in the same place. The immediate field is always sign extended. There's 32 floating point registers, and it can do fuse multiply adds. And it's designed to support position independent code and dynamic linking. So basically, you know, 30 years later, there's a bunch of stuff we learned about RIS, and the kind of the skeleton's good, but we made some tweaks on it. So now I could show you the card that you have, we've handed out. So the left part of the card is this first part, left-hand side of the card is your kind of classic less than 50 RISC integer instructions. Then the privilege instructions, which often get kind of mixed in there, is isolated. There's 14 privilege instructions separated in the card. If you'd like to add multiply and divide, that adds 8 instructions for multiply and divide. If you'd like to have the atomic instructions, there's 11 for that. There's 34 for the single, double, and quadruple position. And if you'd like the compressed instructions, there's 46 for that. And it also adds some instruction formats. So that's all of the extensions for the 32-bit address space. To add the 64 and 128-bit address spaces, we just need instructions to support the wider format. I did this with regex expressions, but this shows you the 12 there for the integer ones. We need 12 more for the wider integer ones, 4 more for the wider multiply and divides, 11 more atomics, and 6 more for the floating point, but that's it. So this card that you have in front of you has the 3 different address sizes and the 6 different optional extensions all there on one slide. Going over a little bit of depth, there's 2 types of atomic instructions. We have the fetch and op kinds with lots of operations, and the load, word, store, conditional, kind of like the MIPS style atomics. And all of them have 2 bits to help us implement either release or sequential consistency. The compressed instructions, which are important not only for embedded devices to have less memory, but also at the high end to have better instruction cache hit rates. It's a really simple idea. There's either a 2-address form with 5-bit fields for the registers, or a 3-address form that uses a subset of the registers. An interesting thing that we did was to require every compressed instruction to map 1-to-1 to a base instruction. So there's a 1-to-1 mapping. So what this means is the assembly language programmer and the compiler can be oblivious to the compressed instructions. So don't have to worry about them. And the hardware to do that is very simple. It takes only 700 gates, so a couple of percent we can get compressed instructions. What it means is all we have to do is be able to put instructions on any 16-bit boundary, and that's not very hard to do. So, and if you do that, like 50 to 60% of all the instructions in the program can use 16 bits, so it becomes 25 or 30% smaller. How does that compare to the other architectures? Well, it depends if you have a 32-bit or 64-bit address. For the 32-bit addresses, lots of people tried to make it smaller, but that wasn't something that people with 64-bit worried about, but we did. But compared to the x86, we're about 25% smaller than the 32-bit and about 30% smaller than that. If we just do the average of all of them, it's 30 to 40%. For some reason, because I've given this talk several times, people are really fascinated about compression. So this is pretty good with just 16-bit and 32. So if we took the original form and we used RVC, we make that kind of improvement. If we use BZIP on the original one, we make it only 25% smaller. So BZIP is, you know, you'd never be able to decode instructions with something in BZIP fast. So there's really not that much space left after the 16 and 32. I think if you went ahead and tried really hard and figured out an encoding, 8-bit, 16-bit, 24, maybe you get 5%, maybe 10%. It'd be a lot of work. You know, tell me what you find, but I don't think there's much left. The privileged architecture, we have 3 different targets. We think of, on the left is the embedded device just running a single application. In the middle is your classic operating system multi-programmed one, and the right is the hypervisor version of it. What we say is for the leftmost one, you just have an application binary interface and an execution environment, which is basically user instructions and the calls for that environment. The supervisor one has the user instructions and the privilege and calls the execution environment. And the hypervisor one, again, has a HBI and calls to the environment. We also are going to have everything's, you know, in a modern world, you'd make everything virtualizable. We think that you can have a single image of the operating system and it can run on any of these. And we also have a hardware abstraction layer to map the device drivers. Our belief is that we can do virtual device drivers, so you'd have one per generic type, like one per disk, rather than one for all disk products in the world, and you do that mapping with the HAL. The supervised architecture, it's either, you know, for an embedded application, you might not have no protection at all, or simply base and bounds, or you could have kind of the classic page virtual address spaces, and we give three versions there. And we weren't trying to innovate in the operating system area. We just wanted to support standard operating systems, and there's a spec released on that. What's available is there's several specs that are available. There's going to be a new compressed instruction set thing this next week or so. But we released them out for comments, and one of the advantages of being an open project, we can put ideas out there and incorporate their comments rather than just announcing it. All the software tools that I can think of, you know, Linux, LLVM, GCC, verification suites. I'll talk to you about the hardware tools, and there's several implementations that you can download. And the software side, there's a bunch of simulators. One that's popular in universities is the one written in JavaScript, because you can just run it in the browser, and it runs at, 10 MIPS or so. Okay, here's the kind of the landscape. There's the foundation at the top. There's government, nonprofit, and commercial efforts. So the foundation is there to promote RISC-V. We've hired an executive director. It's a real foundation. And so far, we're trying to get founding members, and there's seven signed up so far. Three of them are Fortune 50 companies. You'd recognize them, and some of them are smaller companies, even some startups. What about Beyond Berkeley? It's been adopted by India as the standard instruction set. IIT Madras has gotten $80 million. $80 million is even a lot of money for Washington. $80 million to develop six different open source cores. They want to develop a semiconductor industry, and I think there's anxiety about if they were to get other designs, what's really there, fabricated in other countries, they'd like to have their own. A really interesting effort is being done is a nonprofit group. One of the founders of Raspberry Pi wanted to do an SOC where everything was open. There was no restricted things on there. They have a benefactor that's going to fund them, and they plan to make, say, a couple hundred thousands of these low-risk SOCs and put them out there for people to use. And then there's universities doing work and some companies building them. And when we had our first workshop, somebody's already shipped this in a commercial product, and we expect more to be out there. A question I get about, you know, when you started, they didn't have many choices, but since you started, ARM has announced a 64-bit instruction set. It's a RISC instruction set. It's got better ideas similar to yours. Why have you gone ahead and doing it? So I've spent a lot of the last year of my life learning about that because people want a version of the textbook that Hennessy and I developed to use ARM because some students want it more realistic. It's really big. My joke is it's the world's biggest RISC instruction set. How big is it? Typically, RISC architectures have one, maybe two addressing modes. It has eight. How many instructions? More than 1,000, you know? So six times as many as RISC-V. But the thing that's really stunning is how big is the manual. It's 5,428 pages. So it's like, you know, if they had printed it, you know, there'd be four empty forests in England, right? There'd be land available. It's gigantic. I thought since I was I just wanted to use it for my textbook, there must be some overview that I couldn't find one. The best thing they have an overview is a 150-page overview document. What you have to do is just keep reading it over and over and over again until you get the hang of it. So not only is it really one of the biggest instruction sets out there, it's still growing. So this is last December, they, you know, kind of casual announcement, by the way, as they said there, you know, we're announcing, like a lot of other architectures, this is the first set of changes. Atomic read-write instructions, remember the atomic instructions? Okay, well, they've left those out. Loads and stores for configurable addresses. Then here's this instruction they left out, this combination of 10 adjectives together. Yeah, they didn't have that. I bet they didn't have that, but I don't know what it's for. They added a new protection mode. They forgot the dirty bit. And they wanted a bigger ID register. So my kind of reaction to this is like, it reminds me of, you know, like you go for the December holidays and there's a relative that you like and he's kind of overweight, and then you come back to the next year and he's even bigger. It kind of, what's going to happen to them? Well, I think ARM V8 is big, and it's, you know, getting bigger. So that's what I think is going to happen. So what's the big ideas for RISC-V? This core instructions that's never going to change. We promise not to change it. And all the software is going to run on that. These extensions that you include or not. So you can add extensions. Doesn't mean you have to implement them. Only what you need. Opcodes for the future. That's an easy idea, but not been done. This idea of virtualized I/O device drivers. See if that works. And people ask us, what do you mean if it's free? That means it doesn't cost anything. There's no paperwork. And anyone can use it, right? Where ARM, they want to see how many chips you're going to make before they'll do business with you. And the foundation that's going to evolve it slowly versus fast for business reasons. And for both ARM and Intel, they've added on average 2 instructions per month for 30 or 40 years. Okay. That's open architectures. What about some chips? Being Krista and his students, have built 10 chips in the last 4 years. And these are pretty impressive chips. In 45 nanometer technology, it's dual core, 1.7 gigahertz. One of the things we care about is gigaflops per watt. The other one in a more aggressive technology, 28 nanometer, is 1 gigahertz and has adaptive clocking, so it gets more than twice as good in terms of gigaflops per watt. The designs that we've done so far is the simplest one, like for Internet of Things, is only a 3-stage pipeline. How big it is I think this is 40 nanometer technology, it's 1/100 of a millimeter squared. So you could fit 100 of these cores in 1 millimeter squared, a 3-stage pipeline. The rocket design is kind of the classic 5-stage RISC architecture design, but it's got a full MMU, a floating point unit, boots Linux. It's actually a generator. Both of these things are generators, so you can adjust how many cores and how big your cache is and the uncore, and it'll generate all of you. And the most aggressive is called Boom for Berkeley Out of Order Machine. It can fetch between 2 and 4 instructions. It has everything's out of order, can do outstanding loads. So, okay, we've done them. How good are they? If we compare ourselves to the ARM architectures, with the green being the 3-stage pipeline, the blue in the middle being the 5-stage pipeline, and the turquoise on the right being the out of order one, compared to the equivalent ARM architecture in the same technology, it's like 1.5 to 3 times faster. It's generally smaller, except for the low end, because we have 32 registers, they only have 16, and at the low end, that actually is a lot of the chip. And then in terms of energy, it's like 1.5 to 2.5 times more efficient. So compared to the ARM architectures, they're probably more efficient. How did we do that? We used a big thing that we use is Chisel, a modern language for doing hardware design. From a single design in Chisel, we can simultaneously generate a new software simulator, what you need to program an FPGA, and what you need to do layout, so you could see what the cost would be in size and energy. Jonathan Bachrat lit that effort. Basically, it's bringing modern programming language technology to hardware design, which desperately needs it. It's actually not doing high-level synthesis like some people. Instead, the program, as it executes, it writes it. You're writing a generator, and it brings all these big ideas in of object-oriented programming, functional programming, and just much greater ease use. And it's open source. In terms of shared lines of reuse, here's 3 different designs. I told you about them at 3 different times by 3 different groups. And the thing to notice in terms of unique lines of code, in every case, more than half of the code came from something else. And this is not copy and paste copying. This is, modern programming language stuff. So if you made a change in this Zscaler version, the other ones would be automatically updated. We use it in our classroom, and we have some educational versions that are out there for students to use. Now, I would say what we've been doing is agile hardware development. Basically, the big idea in software of Agile is that you do, instead of elaborate planning and documentation, you go from working prototype to working prototype. That's probably a better idea. Now, this works really well for relatively small teams, so-called two-pizza teams. And when you're doing a sprint that lasts 2 to 4 weeks, you have these 15-minute stand-up meetings, and it's a pretty good way to do it. But how do you do that for hardware? Well, what the Berkeley groups came up with is an increasing target for the iteration. So if you're just going to modify the simulator, that just takes a minute from the tools. If you're going to reprogram the FPGA so you can do billions of cycles, that takes about an hour. If you want to get the layout, you have an idea how big things are going to be, that'll take, say, half a day to go through the tools. They came up with this idea to call a tape-in as opposed to shipping the chip out. It's all ready to go out. That means you worry about some design rule violations. That takes a couple of days. We can actually ship chips out, and we would rely on donations or DARPA to pay for them, but not everybody can afford that, so we went out and found out how expensive it is to ship small chips, and then it was such an amazingly low number that we did an op-ed piece about it, and then, of course, you could do a big chip, which would be much more expensive. So how cheap is it? 100 chips at 28 nanometer. We surveyed the readers of EE Times, and their average guess was 170,000, which is maybe that's a reasonable guess. It's $30,000. It only costs $30,000. You can get 100 chips at 28 nanometer for $30,000. That means anybody can afford it to do that. The key idea is a little tiny chip, $30,000, any research project can afford. Any research project here can afford it. You guys get paid, one graduate student is a lot more than $30,000. What the idea is, there's always been these little tiny test chips, but thanks to Moore's law, you can get millions of transistors in a little tiny test chip. We could do two or three of the boom cores, the out-of-order cores, in that stuff. So it's affordable. So RISC-V is a research platform. For $250, you can have something that works that you can modify in an hour. That means you can run in a minute of real processor is an hour on that versus a month on a software simulator. And then you can do 32 at once for just $10,000. It helps publish results. This is a group at Maryland, primarily, who came up with this for ASPLOS, and they got a Best Paper Award. This is a recent result on security for some guys at MIT, and of course, we've published it. To put this in perspective is how many clock cycles you can do on an FPGA. This is running one of the spec programs from beginning to end on the Rocket Core. Each one of those dots is 100 million clock cycles. A lot of papers in the architecture conference are 100 million clock cycles. So I hope if they're sampling, they pick the right sample when they do their study, but you know, it's more convincing when you can run the whole thing. So one reason I'm going on my top 10 tour is to tell people about it. I think it'd be great for security people to go from the criticism to synthesis, right? It's like, Microsoft, you screwed up again, right? Well, okay, that's valuable. But you know, how about you build something that other people can throw things at? You could do that. The low-risk guys who are building these chips, they're adding a tag to architecture to do capabilities. You could do anything you want to add for that. Internet of Things, this is a really small design. And you know, both Berkeley and MIT are using it in the classroom. If you want to learn more about RISC-V, we've held two workshops so far. The next one's going to be in January down in the Bay Area. The other ones have sold out. If you're interested, you should sign up. It's free to academics. Maybe that's why it sells out. but a lot of companies are there too. So I think we're entering this golden era in computer architecture. So I go around and give talks and talk to people. Moore's law is ending, so we're going to have to go to this domain-specific architectures. RISC cores give you something that works and runs a whole software stack that you can, a starting point that you can modify. These agile development ideas and better hardware design languages make it a lot more fun and more productive to design hardware. For $250, you can get this FPGA that can, you know, it runs at 100 megahertz or 50 megahertz, but that's fast enough to run whole operating systems, and you can change it every hour. You can get these chips for $30,000, $300 a chip for a custom chip. What an amazing thing. And so we don't have to wait. We don't have to beg Intel or ARM. If we've got a good idea, you can build it and make it work and demonstrate the idea. So this is a pretty exciting time. So wrapping up before I do conclusions is, you know, the RISC-V thing is this idea of a small base that's never going to change, optional extensions and SoCs, got a whole software stack. And then if the instruction set doesn't matter, why don't we have an open one, right? Like all the other fields. Kind of, you know, I think the opportunity here is in hardware, certainly in systems, is when Matt Welsh resigned from Harvard, he wrote in his blog, well, you can't do systems research anywhere, so I'm going to Google, right? And I think when Rob Pike left Bell Labs working on Plan 9, he says, well, you can't do systems work in research labs anymore, so I'm going to Google. So does everybody have to go to Google or Microsoft? No. Open source is our alternative model. If we get enough people working on something, we can reach to a critical mass where it looks viable, and then even companies help. That's what happened with Linux and LLVM and things like that. I think that could help in here. So I'm here to recruit people to the movement. With that, I'm ready for questions. So after the questions are over, I'll do my 5-minute history, personal history.
There's a lot of ingredients that have made the ARM ecosystem so successful, including standard products that you can just go out and buy without doing chip work that have driven things along. Do you think RISC-V will attract companies that will do standard products?
So the comment is that besides the instruction set architecture for ARM, there's a whole ecosystem around it. And will that happen for RISC-V? So we're pretty sure that like all the buses that ARM have done are open source. We believe the only restriction is you can't use those buses and pretend to have an ARM core that's not licensed. We think that's the only restriction. So ARM, to its credit, has made that all open source. So we have built those same buses, and we and people have integrated devices to it. So we think we'll be able to change instruction sets, but have that whole ecosystem. Yes?
Do you have like a translator or a binary translator so that you can take like an x86 executable or something that compiles x86 and then just have it on this RISC-V so you start?
Yeah, so the question is, do we have a translator, say, from ARM or x86 that could dynamically translate? We haven't done that. But kind of my last little cheerleading, which has been done for several architectures. People have done this where they said, rather than recompile if you lost the source code, we can compile the binaries for the Intel architecture, the ARM, into some other instruction set. Transmeta and others have done this. So it's absolutely technically done. We haven't worked on it, but kind of what the pitch I just made at the end when people bring up things like this is, we haven't done it. That sounds cool. How would you like to do it, right? If we can get enough people doing all these things, then they can reach that critical mass. So yes, I think that would be an interesting thing to do. I think RISC-V would be a really easy target for that translation, and the sources are pretty obvious, and I'm sure that technology exists now, like to go from x86 to ARM. This would be a much easier thing to do than that, but yeah, we'd be great. If you're interested in doing that, I'd encourage you to come to the workshop to see if there's other people doing it. We don't know everything that's going on.
Let's hear the story of your life.
Oh, okay. All right. So I was the first of my family to graduate from college. I was a wrestler and a math major, which is an unusual combination. I think that line about the older you get, the better you were. I'm pretty proud that I was a wrestler. But I had no idea of computer science. I knew what computers were, but I didn't think about it, and no plans for graduate school. It was good enough to graduate from college. Accidental PhD student, John Lubert, who's sitting back there, I think he just got his PhD, and I think he was teaching a compiler course. But I was working in my dad's factory to support myself as a graduate student in my junior year at UCLA. And after the course was over, I really liked it. And I said, just casually to Jean Lubert, I said, wow, I'd sure rather be doing this than working in a factory. And that it was innocent, right? So Jean Lubert, on his own, decided to go find me a job. And he talked to a couple of groups and found me a job. And so I started working as an undergraduate student in a project that he found me. And if he hadn't done that, I wouldn't have gone to graduate school for sure. Changed my life. In fact, how did I end up in a computer science course? I was a math major, and one of my courses were canceled. I had to find a course. And I saw this computer course there. Okay, I'll try it. I had no thought about it. And then once I took a computer course at UCLA at the time, there was no bachelor's degree in computer science yet. So I had to, I took all the courses I could take in the School of Engineering and the Business School, and I was hooked. And once I took that first course, and then John Lubert got me there. While I was a graduate student, we were living in married student housing at UCLA. We had a wife and two sons living on RA ship. After 4 years, the grant ended, and I lost my RA ship with a wife and two kids. It was a big deal. And so my advisor got me a part-time job at Hughes Aircraft, which was an aerospace company nearby. And then I was working 20 or more hours a week, supposedly finishing my PhD while getting paid. So it was touch and go whether I was going to finish my PhD. I'm an accidental academic. My wife grew up in the Bay Area, right next door to Berkeley, and the whole time I was on the interview tour, she said, I just can't help but think we're going to end up at Berkeley. And I tried to explain to her, UCLA is lower in the pecking order, that's not going to happen, you don't understand academics. And finally, I was starting to get job offers, and she said I'd heard from Berkeley, and I hadn't, so she forced me as a graduate student to call the chair of computer science at Berkeley to find out what happened to my application. So I can still remember picking up the phone and calling Ellen Burlikamp, and he's a famous mumbler, so I could barely understand what he's saying. And so, hi, you know, I haven't heard from Berkeley. I didn't say my wife maybe did. I said, hi, I haven't heard from Berkeley. I haven't heard from you. If I heard from you, you know, that's the one place I consider. And so Elwin says, well, Dave, you're in the top 10, but not the top 5. And so I hang up. I thought, oh, that wasn't so bad. So what I found out afterwards, that's what he said to anybody who called. So, but he picks up my application. He gave it to a guy who happened to be going to Southern California. He thought he'd drop by UCLA. We had a nice conversation. He invited me to the interview, and then the rest is here. But I'm only a professor at Berkeley because my wife forced me to humiliate myself. The first project I did as an assistant professor, that guy was kind of my mentor, and I followed what he did. And it was really great ideas, but it was far too ambitious. We didn't have a grant, we didn't have a computer, and we were going to build our own chips and do our own operating systems and everything. So fortunately for me, I took a leave of absence in my third year as an assistant professor, which isn't always a great idea, to digital equipment to do the VAX microcode stuff I told you about. It gave me a chance to rethink my career. As I told you, I came back and did the RIST stuff. But that was right before I came up for tenure. And at the time, you know, we're unusual in that we're the only kind of field on campus that counts, prefers conferences over journals. And so that was very suspicious. And I was kind of the guinea pig to see if you could get tenure based on conferences. And the RIST stuff was just too recent to be a big deal. And I still get my papers rejected by those jerks on the program committee. So what have I learned in my 40 years of professorship here? My guideline has been maximizing personal happiness versus personal wealth. I think growing up in America, you think those two things are the same thing, but they're not. There's a lot of unhappy billionaires, believe it or not. But it seems, why not maximize personal happiness? Okay. Family first. In this job, there's all kinds of people asking you to do things. If you don't make your family number one priority, you know, they can slip pretty far down the line. So I had two sons, my wife had two sons, and growing up, I did everything. I did Indian guides, I was the Cub Scout master, I was the soccer coach, and when there was a field trip, I was there, right? And so, and you know, teenagers grew up, oh, Dad, you were never around. Okay, let's go over this. Indian guides, Cub Scouts. And he says, oh, okay, well, maybe you were around some. Passion, courage, and optimism. I have to really believe in something. Ironically, the physical courage that comes from wrestling turned into intellectual courage, even though there's no logical reason for that. Our projects swing for the fences. We don't bunt for singles. In terms of the courage stuff, this was said a long time ago. Friends may come and go, but enemies accumulate. So that's pretty wise. So you have to be careful picking an enemy. But Ed and I, when I was president of ACM, the guy who was in charge of DARPA during the George W. Bush administration clearly was cutting out academic computer science. So Ed and I decided we would take him on. We tried to find others. They did not want to join the team because they were afraid this guy was vengeful. They were probably appropriately afraid that this guy was vengeful, but that didn't stop Ed and I. We took him on. So the interesting thing is about if there's this guy that's kind of terrifying, but a lot of people don't like, if you take them on, you make a lot of friends. So it turned out okay, although this guy, I think, whenever Ed and I gets in his crosshairs, he reminds us.
Two things about this. One is, back during the Nixon administration, there was a quote that said, it's good to be hated by those who are hated. And that turned out to be this. Here's the other thing this guy did, which was spectacular. Dave and I were arguing that DARPA support of universities was decreasing. He released a PowerPoint graphic, okay, that showed that it was actually going up or holding steady or something like that. And we got hold of this graphic, and it turned out that the spreadsheet was still linked behind the graphic. It wasn't, okay? And the spreadsheet, first of all, omitted the most recent year in which everything went down. And secondly, it omitted a couple of universities at which things had already gone down. So that turned out to be sort of buttress our arguments once we got hold of that.
Thank you, Microsoft.
One of the very important things Microsoft has done for computing research.
it's just in my DNA that you can, a team of people can cooperate and beat an all-star or a team of all-stars. Quoting Fred Brooks, there's no losers on a winning team and no winners on a losing team. I think I'm pretty good at seeking out feedback and learning from it. If somebody doesn't really like my research, I send them a copy of my paper because they're going to tell me exactly what he thinks of it, right? I want to get that feedback. I'm a pretty good writer now, and I think the only reason I got good is my advisor ran out of red ink on his paper, and then I sent my papers to everybody who could write better, and I learned from that. I'd say there's one, besides the positive things, here's my reliable danger side that's worked for my whole life. If you hear of somebody who thinks they're the smartest person in the room, run away. So here are my lifetime examples. The Enron guys, this was the Texas Energy Commodities, and they thought they were, quote, the smartest guys in the room. So their chairman and CEO went to prison. There's a university professor in my field who I've been told thinks that, and everybody hates this guy. The president of a top college who thinks that way, and he was fired. And I've got an in-law who thought that way, and he's in prison too. So, and I think what it is, so why would somebody who thinks they're the smartest person in the room, this happen? Well, first of all, nobody, who would want somebody who thinks that on their team, right? They wouldn't be on a team. And if you're the smartest person in the room, you don't need any feedback from anybody. You're the smartest person in the room. So I think they violate the first two laws. But trust me, you'd run away if you hear that. The other kind of funny thing that happened to me, one big thing at a time. I woke up one morning, maybe 10 years in a career, and it was like, I still remember, it's like God whispered in my ear. It's not how many projects you start, it's how many you finish. It was like, well, that seems obviously true, but it hit me hard. Like a lot of faculty, I had a lot of balls in the air all the time. And after God spoke to me, I said, okay, I'm going to do one big thing at a time. So when Hennessy and I did our textbook, that was the big thing we did. When I was president of ACM, I took a sabbatical, that was the big thing we did. So, you do some things, but you try to do one big thing at a time, and then over time, the difference is you get a lot of things done, unlike a lot of people who do a lot of things. My final advice is work hard and play hard, which is kind of trite. You hear that a lot. The first part of that is work hard. Jim Gray, beloved guy, famous guy, he worked really hard. He stayed up, he did an all-nighter once a month for that. I work pretty hard. So you got to work hard. But you got to play hard, too. This isn't a warm-up from some future life. This is it, right? especially adults tend to forget to play, right? As you get older, you run out of time to do that. So for me, I can do a lot of, as long as I can play soccer every Sunday, ride my bike, I can handle a lot of stuff. But make sure you not only work hard, but play hard. Okay, that's my life story. Okay.